The English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: multiple rockets land at Iraq's Ain al-Assad air base that hosts American forces. Iran's president says preserving the 2015 nuclear deal is possible only if its signatories take practical measures, noting the U.S. has failed to take any steps to remove its sanctions on Tehran. And also, Brazil registers an all-time record for the number of COVID-related deaths in a single day, with over 1,600 people dying from the disease. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: multiple rockets have hit Iraq's Ain al-Assad air base that hosts foreign forces, including U.S. troops. The U.S. has confirmed the attack. No casualties have been reported so far. There is no immediate claim of responsibility. Ain al-Assad air base is located in Iraq's western Anbar province. American forces and their supply convoys have repeatedly been targeted in Iraq in recent months amid growing anti-U.S. sentiments there. Anger mounted after the U.S. assassinated top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in January last year. Shortly after the assassinations, the Iraqi parliament approved the withdrawal of U.S. forces from the country. Baghdad-based reporter from IRIB Bureau Navid Behrouz earlier joined us and gave us details about the latest attack on Ain al-Assad air base in Iraq.
10 rockets of Katyusha type were fired from the Al-Bayadir hit, which is located near this base. Those rockets were fired from that area and targeted Ain al-Assad air base. 10 Katyusha rockets hit that base. Based on the incoming reports, they landed at the southern part of the air base, that is where the dormitory of American forces is located, and immediately after the attack, we witnessed sorties and flights by American helicopters and aircraft over the Ain al-Assad air base, and also columns of smoke were seen rising from Ain al-Assad base. The eyewitnesses are saying that so far no group has claimed responsibility for the attack, and this attack definitely was in response to an earlier attack last week by the U.S. against the popular mobilization units forces here in the same province, Al-Anbar province. It happened on the Iraqi soil. This attack is in response to that attack, and resistance groups had already announced that they would respond to the U.S. attack. So this attack is probably a response to the U.S. attack, and that proves that resistance groups have proved that they are capable of responding to American attacks despite all security measures adopted by the U.S. military in that area.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says the United States has not taken any considerable steps to remove its sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Rouhani said the current U.S. administration should strongly denounce its predecessor's actions against Iran if it deems them wrong. He called on Washington to return to its commitments under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Rouhani said the standoff over the accord can be resolved easily if the U.S. lifts all sanctions, and then Iran will return to full compliance. He said paying lip service about preserving the agreement does not work, and that Iran needs to see practical measures. Former U.S. President Donald Trump walked out of the multilateral accord in 2018 and reinstated tough sanctions on Iran. A year later, Iran began reducing its obligations. Russia has urged the U.S. not to play with fire after Washington announced new sanctions over the poisoning of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Moscow said the sanctions were evidence of what it called a hostile anti-Russian lunge. Russia said it will continue to resolutely defend its national interests and rebuff aggression. Moscow promised to retaliate and warned the new U.S. sanctions will harm bilateral ties. Washington imposed penalties on Tuesday in a coordinated action with the European Union. The sanctions target senior Russian government officials and entities. The U.S. and the EU say the Russian government was behind the last year poisoning of Navalny. Moscow strongly denies that. Another two people are killed in the city of Mandalay in Myanmar as the country's military presses with its crackdown on anti-coup demonstrators. Security forces fired in the air and used tear gas to break up demonstrations in the cities of Yangon and Mandalay. The junta has also charged six journalists over their coverage of the protests. At least 23 protesters have been killed across Myanmar since the anti-coup rallies began early last month. The military alleged that November elections had been rigged. It detained civilian officials, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and President Win Myint. The president is now facing two new charges. On Tuesday, a regional diplomatic push to help end the month-long crisis made little headway. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan says the charges leveled by Myanmar's junta against ousted de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi are unfounded.
But these are trumped-up charges. They're baseless. And actually, they're ridiculous. But, you know, the UN Security Council has not taken a strong stand. And we have to wait and see what the American and British and other Western corporations, if they think they can make money there. The junta wants to maintain the power that they've had in the past. They had held Suu Kyi in house arrest for 6 years. The Myanmar military is like a separate institution. It runs parallel to the government, but it's not really controlled by the government. And it's also one of the largest armies in the world, even though Myanmar is a relatively poor country. So the military has tremendous power and control. And I think they were shocked that Suu Kyi's party, National League for Democracy, had won a strong mandate in the elections that were held in November of last year. So they fabricate this excuse, as far as I'm concerned, that there was fraud in the election, but I've seen no evidence of fraud.
Israel is moving to protect hundreds of its nationals, including the regime's military affairs minister, Benny Gantz, who might be subject to war crimes probes by the International Criminal Court. Gantz says Israel, which is not a member of the court, rejects the ICC's jurisdiction and is working on how to protect the Israelis against possible probes. The Hague-based tribunal ruled that last month that it has jurisdiction over the occupied West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem al-Quds, and the ruling could lead to criminal investigations in the area. The ICC is set to look into Israel's disproportionate use of force in the 2014 war on Gaza, its settlement activities, and the regime's deputy response to the 2018 protests by Palestinians. Brazil has logged over 1,600 new deaths, the country's highest single-day COVID-19 fatalities recorded so far. Today's figure put Brazil's total death toll at more than 257,000. The health ministry also reported nearly 60,000 new infections, bringing the country's total to over 10.6 million cases. Also in Latin America, Mexico announced nearly 8,000 new infections and just over 1,000 deaths. According to data from the Johns Hopkins University, the United States remains the world's worst-hit nation by the respiratory disease, with nearly 28.8 million cases and more than 516,000 fatalities. Israel has approved a plan for the construction of about 1,000 new settler units in East Jerusalem al-Quds. The approval comes despite international calls on Israel to stop its settlement expansion projects on occupied Palestinian land. Mona Kandil reports.
Israeli regime approved the building of 930 settlement units in the illegal settlement of Beis Gad Ze'ev in the heart of occupied Jerusalem al-Quds. Anti-settlement groups said the new units will be established on land seized from the villages of Beit Hanina, Hizma, and Anata, northeast Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Israeli media quoted the Israeli mayor of Al-Quds, Moshe Lion, saying the new units are part of a plan amounting to 400 million shekels, around $122 million, to expand and support the settlements of Ramat Shlomo, Gilo, and Givat Hamatis, north and south the city.
This is targeting the Palestinian communities inside Jerusalem, Beit Hanina, Anata, and Hizma. It's a neighborhood, Palestinian neighborhood in East Jerusalem, and building the settlements in there, in Beit Hanina, for example, they are expanding the settlement in Beit Hanina there. It doesn't leave any room for the Palestinian community there to expand anymore. Just need block it, either from the south by this block of settlement, from the north by a highway, a bypass road that they are doing.
In addition to its attempts to expand settlements in the Holy City and establish highways to link between the settlements inside Al-Quds and settlements outside it, Israel demolishes Palestinian homes under the claim they are built without Israeli issued permits. Experts say Tel Aviv continues to establish more facts on the ground designed toward a greater Jewish majority in East Jerusalem Al-Quds, aiming to create a new reality that makes realizing the two-state solution and Palestine's sovereignty over the city impossible.
What goes on in Jerusalem Al-Quds amounts to silent eviction of the Palestinians. Israel plans to Judaize the city and conduct ethnic cleansing against the Palestinians. It aims to impose new identity on the city.
Palestinian officials had warned several days ago that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was planning to build thousands of settlement units for Orthodox Jews to encourage unity among religious Zionist parties before the Israeli elections that are set for March 23, especially that Netanyahu has no clear path to staying in power. Some might argue that Trump's so-called deal of the century is dead, but the reality on the ground is different, as Israel continuously approves construction of new settlements on occupied Palestinian territory. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Stranded migrants have demonstrated in Mexico City of Tijuana on the U.S. border. They've called on the new U.S. administration to let them enter the country. The migrants demanded entry despite having no active cases in migrant protection protocols. That's a program launched under former U.S. President Donald Trump. It forced more than 65,000 asylum seekers back to Mexico while their cases were being heard by U.S. immigration courts. The Biden administration has reversed Trump's policy, but for now, it is only processing active cases. Migrants without such cases have been waiting months in the Mexican camps. They are mainly from Central American countries and want to enter the U.S. in search of a better life. A major Canadian advocacy group has accused authorities in the country of turning a blind eye to increasing violence against Muslim women. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our News Review program. Let's take a listen.
A major Muslim organization in Canada has called for the immediate creation of a bipartisan committee to deal with racist and Islamophobic crimes in the country. National Council of Canadian Muslims says racism is a real problem in Canada. And the advocacy group has accused authorities of turning a blind eye to the crisis. Remarks follow a spate of recent attacks against black Muslims. Five Somali-Canadian Muslim women were assaulted in the city of Edmonton in the past 10 weeks. Last year, more than 60 such crimes were reported in the city. And now joining us for this news review is Robert Fan, Tina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario, and Firas Al-Najim, manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, joining us out of Ottawa, Ontario. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. Firas, we're going to start with you, if it's okay. Firas, you know, I was basically looking at all the Islamophobic attack on Muslim women in Canada from 2008 to recently. There's tons of them, malls, universities out on the streets with their kids, getting punched in the faces, getting their hijab pulled off. This is obviously a huge problem, not just with respect to Somali women, but it's a problem against Muslim people in general. What's going on in Canada?
Yes, best regards to Press TV staff and all viewers. Yes, I mean, this has been ongoing for many years. I mean, and the media has a big role in this because the media, especially from the States, has a big influence on the Canadian media as well because people watch all the news from North America. Tyrant Trump, you know, in his administration and his arrogance, he was very Islamophobic. His administration always spoke in ways, Fox News, even the news in Canada, a lot of it is Islamophobic. There's a lot of Islamophobia in there, you know, and they try to label Muslims as terrorists. And the word, for instance, Islamist is always affiliated with terrorism. And Islamist means a person that is Islamic, you know what I mean? So when you use that word and you keep deliberately using that word, it causes people to affiliate always Islamic religion with terrorism or with extremism or with radicalism or with attacks and things like that. So they've really kind of embedded this in people's mentalities, and unfortunately there is a lot of hate crimes that are happening everywhere. Now there's a the most people I think that actually get attacked are females, unfortunately, right? Because they're more vulnerable. They're, you know, people think that they're easier to attack, and the women in Canada have to always prove their innocence in a way. They have to always show that, you know, we're not here to impose our Sharia law. We're not here to, you know, we're not abused at home. We're not discriminated by our husbands, you know, because of this narratives that they sell on media in different places. This needs to be combated. This is a very delayed process now. I mean, Islamophobia itself should be a hate crime that is described in detail, and there should be a law that is, you know, adopted as a criminal code to get people, to have people arrested and charged on this. I would like to also say that the Prime Minister of Canada, Trudeau, I would have to say in this perspective, on this file, he's done a pretty good job. I mean, when there was an attack in Montreal, in Quebec, I mean, and they attacked a mosque, and there was, you know, it was a massacre, it was a tragic, and he called it a terrorist attack. And that's, in our modern time, that was the first time I hear a Western leader pretty much call a white supremacist, non-Muslim attacker a terrorist. So that was a good initiative on that part. And they did also work on making a day, January 29th, would be a day to mark the Quebec attack and also call it a day of action against Islamophobia. So there is some work happening from the government's point part. But the thing is, there's got to be a lot more work from organizations, and the government really needs to do something about it. Because don't forget, Canada is also split up. Different provinces have different political parties, such as the Conservatives. The Conservatives are very Islamophobic. They're very racist. They rarely have any black members in their system or in their parties. So this has also had a role play, because Harper was ruling before Prime Minister Trudeau, and he was very, you know, close-minded, and he was against Muslims on a big level. You know what I mean? So, thanks. I mean, there's a lot of work to be done. Yes.
Thank you, Firaz. And Robert, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Your thoughts on the rap that Canadian Muslims are receiving, and what more the government can do to address it. And to Firaz's point, I mean, we have anti-Semitism to protect Jews. Why can't Islamophobia be a law that anti-Muslim? Why can't Islamophobia be a crime that protects Muslims?
It should absolutely be a crime, and these assaults on these women should all be prosecuted as hate crimes. As Firaz said, a Muslim woman have to prove themselves to people that they're simply minding their own business, they're not terrorists, and so on. And that is totally wrong. They shouldn't have to prove anything more than any other woman in Canada has to prove. And that's simply that they have nothing to prove. They're just going about their business, living their lives, regardless of whether they wear a hijab or not. It's just, these are Canadians. They're entitled to live in Canada just like anybody else, and should be able to walk the streets at any time they want to without fear of this violence that has been coming up on them. The government needs to make Islamophobic crimes hate crimes. It needs to speak out more forcefully about Islamophobia and condemn it more, whether it's mentioned in Parliament or whether they see it on news programs talking about or equating Muslims with terrorists. This is simply wrong. It's very typical in the United States, certainly, but it has no place there or in Canada. Canadian self-image is that of openness and tolerance, but these crimes belie that image, and they need to be addressed, and these crimes need to be addressed very firmly, very strongly, and promptly when they occur.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us. Pleasure to have you both on the program once again. Robert Fantina from Kitchener, Ontario, and Firaz Al-Najim joining us there out of Ottawa. And that's a wrap for the segment of News Review. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Well, that's a wrap for now.
IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Second phase of the revolution.
Of the revolution. Of the revolution. Of the
revolution. Leap in production. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said that the aim of economy in the country is to produce wealth and distribute it justly among people. Then he stressed that workers are among the main factors for production of wealth. He said, in the current world and the speedy technological developments, it is a necessity for production groups and workers to continuously learn and use the previous experiences in order to increase economic prosperity through promotion of productivity. Ayatollah Khamenei said that production is the main factor in formation of a national and strong economy, while calling the current Iranian year, which is in its last month as the year of leap in production, he said, production, besides being vital for the country's economy, has many political, social, and cultural impacts in so that a nation's ability to produce its basic needs will give it self-confidence and will pave the ground for public welfare of society, increase gross domestic production, increase exports, and have cultural impacts of exported goods in other countries. The leader considered the current condition of production inadequate in the country and, emphasizing on the need for further strengthening of production, mentioned some points for acceleration of production in the present circumstances. Valid scientific reports indicate that using scientific capacities in various sectors in the country has led to advancement in defense power, medical fields, and control of diseases, engineering fields, biotechnology and related products, peaceful nuclear technology, and so on. In view of this, leap in production is important in two aspects. Firstly, leap in production will increase the share of production in the domestic economic move and will push in the course of the advancing goals. Secondly, the demand for science and technology will increase in accordance with economic progress, and the more the national ability to meet this demand, the results will be more palpable. Iran has attained remarkable indices in the field of scientific growth despite harsh sanctions. According to the statistics, Iranian researchers have gained 1.58% of scientific growth in the world. Ayatollah Khamenei, in his statement for the second phase of the Islamic Revolution, puts emphasis on a strong economy and negation of the enemy's influence and infiltration. He says, brilliant youth should consider their main goal in reaching the boundaries of knowledge and technology and pushing forward these boundaries. Dear listeners, the Islamic Republic has proven that if a nation wants to achieve identity, dignity, and security in every field, it requires persistence, self-belief, and self-sacrifice. For over four decades, the United States has used different levers to keep Iran behind in sciences, but the Iranian nation has firmly stood against the U.S. The leader says, one of the necessities of the great Iranian nation's struggle against the arrogance are all-out steadfastness, endeavor, and move for progress of the country in scientific and construction fields, which will pave the ground for prosperity and victory. Elsewhere in his remarks addressing researchers, he said, any nation that falls behind new sciences and technologies will have no faith but backwardness, humility, and colonization by powers. Therefore, this speed of scientific move should not decrease or stop in a country. It should rather be kept and strengthened for long years till reaching the scientific pinnacle. Dear friends, all these achievements are the outcome of resistance against pressures. Leap in production is also a targeted move, which will bear fruit in midterm and long term. Reduction of scientific, technological, and industrial distance with advanced nations requires innovation in industry and finding new courses for shortcuts. The health system in Iran has proven that it enjoys extraordinary know-how, experience, and staff, which can offer its findings to other nations in various fields, including coronavirus. The Islamic Republic of Iran is the only country in the region that has achieved the knowledge of launching and construction of satellites. In fact, it is considered among five new powers in space technology. Richard Stone of the Science magazine says, I am familiar with Iran's scientific community, and I should say that despite sanctions that Iran has tolerated, the country's scientific community has shown extraordinary creativity and resilience in overcoming sanctions. It has kept its competitiveness in the global scientific community. Iran is a pioneer in various scientific and technological spheres, particularly nuclear know-how.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Washington has placed sanctions on several Russian officials over what it alleges to be the chemical poisoning of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. These are the first sanctions to target Russia since Biden took the helm at the White House. Joe Biden says that the U.S. will no longer be, quote, rolling over in the face of what he calls aggressive action by Russia. The European Union already restricted travel and froze the assets of six Russians in October, and this week's sanctions will be the first under the EU's new human rights regime. How effective a punishment could the sanctions prove to be? How would relations between Russia and the West be impacted?
Relations between Moscow and Washington are deteriorating over the imprisonment and alleged poisoning of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. The U.S. has imposed sanctions on several Russian individuals and entities over the case. It accused the Kremlin of being behind the poisoning and renewed demands for Navalny's release. Washington says the move was taken in coordination with the European Union, which has already sanctioned four senior Russian justice and law enforcement officials. Prior to the U.S. announcement, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov had warned that his country will respond to Washington's sanctions proportionately.
"We will respond without fail. Reciprocity is one of the rules of diplomacy. We have repeatedly said what we think of illegitimate unilateral sanctions. The American colleagues, as well as the European Union that follows the U.S. lead, tend to resort to, for practically no reason. When they have nothing to say to back the allegations about Navalny's poisoning, they begin to punish us. I think it does no credit to anyone who takes such decisions."
Analysts believe that the U.S. and its European allies are politicizing the case and are interfering in Russia's internal affairs.
"This is an obvious case of blatant meddling in the internal affairs of the Russian Federation. And they have, the European Court of so-called human rights has not given any justification except for political talk for why they made this decision."
Navalny was rushed to a local hospital in the Siberian city of Omsk on August 20th after collapsing on a Moscow-bound flight. He fell into a coma and was put on a ventilator in an intensive care unit. 2 days later, he was airlifted to Berlin for treatment. On September 2nd, Berlin claimed that German government toxicologists, after examining Navalny's test samples, concluded that he had been affected by a toxic agent belonging to the Novichok family. Moscow denied any involvement, saying it has been no proof Navalny was poisoned. It also said that Russian doctors detected no poisonous substance in Navalny's system prior to his transfer to Berlin. The Kremlin critic was arrested in January upon his return from Germany. Last month, a Russian court gave him 2.5 years in jail for violating a 2014 parole. The relations between Russia and the West have been thorny over a host of issues. Their ties deteriorated due to various sanctions imposed over Russia, citing its involvement in the crisis in eastern Ukraine and alleged interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. The latest pretext to target Russia by the U.S. and its allies threatened to take the relationship to a new low and fuel tensions further.
Okay, that was a report by Matthew Fetterman. Let's get down to business. Joining me in this debate show will be veteran journalist and political activist Christoph Horstel from Berlin, and also a lecturer with Brown University, Vladimir Goldstein, who's joining us out of Rhode Island. Good to have both of you, gentlemen. Let's go to Berlin first. Christoph, the Kremlin argues that the new U.S. sanctions over the Navalny case would be futile and would only exacerbate the already strained relations. Do you think the sanctions could achieve their goal?
Not at all. Of course, not at all. To my best understanding, Navalny is taking his steps following Khodorkovsky, who was once the richest man in Russia. The helm went from Khodorkovsky to Navalny in 2017, in April, when Khodorkovsky was the person who asked the Russian people to vote for Navalny. And Navalny, to my best understanding, is a CIA and BND Bundesnachrichtendienst agent. This is his behavior. This is his financing. This is the support he had when he was in Germany and for months very active, instead of, you know, fulfilling his parole in Russia, to make a very strange and hectic anti-Putin movie which failed to do the trick.
Now let's turn to Rhode Island. Vladimir, what's the reason making Biden's push for tougher measures against Moscow? You know, the previous administration did not take action regarding this case.
Well, Biden basically wants to reassert the United States in the position versus Russia. And he uses this Navalny case as a pretext to rally allies, to rally Europeans, to rally United States, to say that we, United States, are back in the driving seat. We're going to define the good behavior, we're going to define bad behavior, we're going to define the sanctions, and you have to follow. That's kind of that's something which President Trump didn't do. So Biden, basically, this is a message to European allies that we are back in business. How effective it's going to be, how credible it is, it's not credible at all, it's not effective, because we know, first of all, EU do not have any unity. There is like Eastern Europeans who scream for sanctions. This is their main reason for existence. It's like sanctions against Russia. Russia is a threat. You know, all the European countries, including Germany, are not that fascinated with it. They want to have big relationship. United States people want to have relationship. So the whole thing is kind of divided inside, but on the surface of it, Biden wants to project the aura of unity, or working in consolidation. So I would say the sanctions are largely symbolic, and they are not particularly serious. So the very fact that they take top people in Russian government, which deals with security and prison and so on, and take away their visas, it's kind of rather symbolic, and I'm sure Russia will do the same. But it sends a message to European allies that we are in charge, and we're together, we're backing, and we want to work in unison. So that's that typical thing. Nobody should expect anything particularly interesting from Biden. He will try to sort of go on with the traditional sort of policies, that's all.
Now, Christoph, the Kremlin insists that this is a domestic issue and considers other countries' comments and measures against it as interference. How do you look at the issue?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, Russia is right, very much right in this case. It is a video which was published that the MI6 was meeting a friend of Navalny in Moscow. And that friend was asking for $10 to $20 million per year to the so-called opposition. And that would help that opposition. And that friend also asked for MI6 intelligence on corruption in Russia, which then Navalny would sell in the public as his research, and then accuse Russian officials of corruption. Of course, there is corruption. That's correct. And of course, that must be attacked. Correct. But who, as a credible opposition figure, would go to a foreign secret service? I have never done this in my whole life, and I have a lot of corruption to, you know, talk about in Germany, and then ask a foreign secret service for financial assistance through his friend. This is outright crazy, and it is better for everybody not involved, non-Russian, to keep his dirty fingers out of this dirty game. It has nothing to do with a credible opposition in Russia, which is necessary because we have many, you know, difficult situations and problems in Russia, but please not this way. That is one thing. And the sanction, you know, the most interesting game is now being played about the Nord Stream 2 double tube gas pipeline project in the Eastern Sea. And that is something so vital for Germany and Europe, and not as vital for Russia, by the way, because they have this huge Chinese market to care for. But one thing is clear, Washington is trying its level best to stop this project in the last second. They cannot succeed, and that is the real game behind the scenes. And obviously the sanctions now being declared about Russia, that's just, you know, a little game. That's nothing really serious. And it's, of course, something where Russia, which is a very diplomatic, guided country, that they can easily re-prosecute, because, of course, this is little stuff. That is peanuts, so to say. The big thing is the Nord Stream 2 project, and that is being, you know, fought about right now behind closed doors.
Right. And, Vladimir, why should the West, particularly the United States, show so much concern regarding Navalny's case and threaten Russia with sanctions? Are they really worried about freedoms and rights violations?
Yeah, not... Are you asking
me? Not at all.
Vladimir, please.
Had they been worried about it, they would have been, you know, worried about such cases like Julian Assange and so on. This is a pretext, and I would say it's a red herring. That's what we have to remember. that the United States experiences a really serious crisis of identity. They don't know where they're going. They don't know how to solve. And listen to a very simple thing. Blaming Russia, trying to find a pretext, even though, you know, if you look inside the country, there's a tremendous amount of problems, from policemen running around loose, killing people, to, you know, economy in a bad shape, and so on. So what in my country, he is growing up as a teenager. Every time we hear from the decrepit Brezhnev regime, oh, how bad it is in the United States, and there is this prisoner, Angela Davis, who was a professor at Berkeley, who was arrested, and we demand her freedom, and we want to do sanctions. So this is, and we know where Brezhnev regime ended. So for me, this is a replay, lack of vision, lack of strategy, lack of policy, and giving population the semblance that we're going through some motions, we're doing some sanctions, we're tough, we're not like Trump, we're going to show Russia. But it's just basically for domestic consumption, and of course we know that the enemy which is on decline is dangerous. So Russia shouldn't relax, China shouldn't relax, Iran shouldn't relax. But basically, you know, this is a very good sign of decline of United States and their vision and policy.
Right. Okay, Chris, go ahead with your comments. Do you share the same view?
Yes, quite so. Very, very obviously, if Joe Biden thinks he's getting into business now with this kind of little nonsense, he's in fact kicking himself and his good nation out of it. That is a very sorry state. Donald Trump was from the start very open towards factually improving relations between the US and Russia. That was a very, very good goal to have, and deep state did not allow him. What is this? An American president in his tenure is inviting an important foreign leader like Vladimir Putin twice to the White House, and he was not allowed to pull through. Putin was not allowed to visit Washington, visit Donald Trump in the White House. Donald Trump wanted to improve the relations even as a candidate for the presidency, and then had to wait for 1.5 years to pull through with this meeting. And you know what happened, this kind of witch hunt, he very correctly stated about his Russia relation and how he waited for such a long time, and then he spent, which is not allowed obviously for a US president because he might sell his country, yeah, crazy accusation, 2 hours without witnesses with the Russian president, and nobody was allowed to be there. And the rumors which were then being spread by the cartel media, the big deep state owned American media, who accused Trump not to be a reliable patriotic president. How crazy is this? This was a very patriotic president who did a very sensible thing. That means he went to the next big power and said, let's sit together, let's talk, let's find commune ways for the future. And that was very important, that was very political, and Joe Biden has nothing of this. I'm very, very, you know, deeply concerned that our American friends are in such a ridiculous kindergarten way, kicking themselves out of politics in the way they behave towards Russia. That is so stupid. And it will not, of course, succeed due to a very simple fact. We have two fantastic foreign policy managers in Moscow right now. One is this wonderful Foreign Minister Lavrov, and the other one is Vladimir Putin himself, who speaks fantastic fluid German. And this is something which we have to keep in mind. These guys will outlive any stupid Western approach. Does it come now from Washington or from Paris or from Berlin? Doesn't matter. They will outlive that until European people right now will try to liberate themselves from this disgusting kind of, you know, governments which are always disturbing intelligent and good steps towards peace and cooperation in the world. This is the fact we have right now. It's a very sorry state for Washington.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Vladimir, to what extent could the Navalny case dent Moscow-Washington's relationship? Because, you know, the relations are already tense.
they are tense, and I don't think Russia's expected much of the improvement. But I think, you know, so far, not like drastic change. I think, as I said, they're going, Biden goes through symbolic gestures, saying that he's not going to be like Trump. This is very important for his voter base, that he's not going to be as Trump. He sends a message to Europeans that will try to work as previous Obama administration did. So that's symbolic. I don't think he did anything very drastic, for example, despite Eastern Europeans' demand and to do something about Nord Stream, he didn't do anything. So, in other words, it's important gestures. I don't think, you know, his heart is into that. He uses it as a smokescreen, as a red herring. And he has some visions of domestic policy, and that's what you have to do. But, you know, I would also add that, you know, they poison attitudes and relationships. There is a time where in 21st century, time to revision a Russia-U.S. relationship, U.S.-European relationship, even time to revision EU a constituency. Why EU has to have these strange countries there, which is, they don't have Russia, which is like integral part of Europe, and they have all these the Baltic states or Ukraine, not Ukraine, or sort of Baltic states, Romania, Bulgaria, whom they turn into, you know, their vassals. And, you know, this is kind of not a valuable body, political body. So EU is kind of eroding. United States-EU relationship are kind of falling apart. So that's what they have to revisit first and bring Russia on, you know, because any decision which is related to the world, to Europe, has to involve Russia. So why not somehow United States talk to EU, European countries like, you know, Baltic states or Poland, but not to Russia, and think they're going to solve anything? It's just old thinking, old politics. But Biden is an old guy, and his continuation, he was a vice president under Obama, and that will he'll continue. So I agree with Christoph. Russia will outlive this, and I think we'll have to wait to another president to start seeing things differently.
Now, Christoph, Washington imposes new sanctions on Russia at the same time it claims that it wants to work with Moscow over Iran and North Korea, for instance. What's the U.S. Policy vis-a-vis Russia?
The problem is with them, they have, as Vladimir rightly put it, a very old-fashioned way of showing off about policy. We know what this is. This is a kowtow that is bowing down to the American deep state, especially if it comes to Iran, of course, because this deep state is, you know, Zionist rule, and there are Zionists of this kind. I would say, for example, the owners of the New York Times, they are somehow moderates, but there are others who are a lot crazier than this one. And again, how to say, this American government is very strongly moving against Iran. What we see here is a provocation, for example, with this stupid vessel in the Persian Gulf, where Iran is truly, I must laugh when I think about it, accused of attacking this vessel, which is belonging to a close friend of the Mossad boss. Yeah, it is very obviously for anybody who is 3 or 5 days in politics that Iran would not, you know, give the Israelis such an advantage as to attacking this ship. But in fact, if we listen to Tel Aviv, you know, and you own a vessel and this is running around the Persian Gulf, the best thing, if you get any damage, is strictly advisable to talk to Tel Aviv directly and ask the Israelis to, you know, pay the damage. I think that is the most intelligent thing to do. So the U.S. is, in fact, in a very bad flow right now, because this so-called anti-Trump mood they have to serve, that is, of course, you know, the theater we are being played every day. That is a deep state theater. Biden has no, you know, force whatsoever. He's not being forced to do anything bad against Russia or anything stupid against Iran. No need for that. He could very clearly, you know, open discussion and talk sense and not talk preconditions when the U.S., for example, never fulfilled the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, and Iran also always overdid it by 105%. So this is totally crazy what we have right now in the situation. Washington's, in fact, isolating itself in a very crazy way. And I do understand that Biden is not the leading person. But
Crystal, I have to jump in. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Sorry for cutting you. We're out of time. That's all the time we had. So let me thank our guests. We had veteran journalist and political activist Christoph Forstall from Berlin and lecturer with Brown University, Vladimir Goldstein, who joined us out of Rhode Island with his contribution. I'll be your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Aysel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We're up to chapter 6, which is the chapter of the etiquette of eating and drinking. We were talking about the adab, the etiquette, the mannerism of eating, and we mentioned a variety of things that need to be taken into consideration by a mu'min, a mu'minah, in regards to what it is that we should do when it does come to dealing with food, when treating food, when being in the presence of food. Next adab, next etiquette is for you to sit simply, sit with humbleness. Hadiths say that you shouldn't sit with your legs crossed. You should sit in such a way as is the sunnah of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, jalsatul abd. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, إذا جلس أحدكم على الطعام فليجلس جلسة العبد. Jalsatul abd is basically with having one knee in front of you and one knee towards your chest, which is the jalsa of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi when it comes to eating. This is the sunnah of the Holy Prophet when it comes to eating. And this is jalsatul abd. It's called jalsatul abd. Now, there's also some ahadith that say that you should be leaning on your, a little bit on your left, for example, and other things like that, which is, you know, also discussed in certain books. Make sure that you are eating calmly, you're eating slowly, you don't hasten in your food. Make sure that you chew your food. And there are many ahadith that talk specifically about chewing your foods in certain ways. A very interesting hadith says that the reason you, why, another reason why you should be eating slowly, besides the fact of it being good for your digestive system and things like that, is that when you are sitting with others on a sufra, on ma'idatul ta'am, this will be a time that you will not be accountable for. So this time, this duration that you are sitting, you're not going to be accountable in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is really, really interesting. You know, Imam Sadiq, salamullahi alayhi, says, atilul julus, prolong your sitting down on the table of food, ala al-ma'ida, fa'innaha sa'atun la tuhsab min a'marikum, because this is, will be a time that will not be counted from among your life, which is interesting indeed. If you are invited, accept the invitation. If you have been asked to eat with someone, it is wrong for you to reject. Accept the invitation. How about if you have not been invited? Then you should not be putting the host in a situation and knowing that you weren't invited, but you turn up anyway. You know, that's of course a bad thing, a negative thing.
Ayatollah Javadi Amiri, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
The Holy Prophet says, Ya Ali, thamaniyatun in uhinu fala yalumu illa anfusuhum. There are eight kind of people where if they were insulted, they can't blame anyone other than themselves. Al-dhahibu ila ma'idatin lam yud'a ilayha. Someone who goes to an invitation that they were not invited to. You know, if they are insulted, then they should not blame anyone other than themselves. Then we have the interesting ahadith that are focused, and these come from Imam al-Ridha, salamullahi alayhi. And, you know, if you do go back to the traditions from Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha, salam Allah alayhi, you'll see a lot of them are related to food and